Disney's Disneyland.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are.
Each week as you enter this timeless land, one of these many worlds will open to you. Fantasyland, the happiest kingdom of them all. Tomorrowland, promise of things to come. Adventureland, the wonder world of nature's own realm. Frontierland, tall tales and true from the legendary past, presenting this week from Frontierland, Davy Crockett, Indian fighter. And now, Walt Disney.
It's characteristic of American folklore that most of our favorite legends and fables are based on the lives of real men, like Davy Crockett of Tennessee.
Born on the mountaintop in Tennessee, green estate in the land of the free, raised in the woods so's he knew every tree, killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
Welcome, dreamers of all ages, to another episode of Unbuilt, an unrealized theme park podcast. With me today, as always, is my co-host Ryan Dorman. Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, I'm spending it exactly where I want to spend it.
I know.
On the Unbuilt podcast.
Yeah, you might not be listening to this on Valentine's Day, but that is when we are recording.
That's right.
And, you know, it's funny. When I set this episode up, I had no idea what day it was. Like, I had zero clue until somebody pointed that out to me. They're like, how are you spending your Valentine's Day? It's, wait, what day is Valentine's Day? It's Wednesday. I was like,
how do we make this episode more romantic, Ryan?
Yeah.
How can we really get into the spirit of the holiday?
Mm-hmm. We could talk about exactly what we loved to see this week, and I don't know about you, but I did love to see that Tiana animatronic without a projected face.
It looked really nice. It's interesting to see something. You know that video where they go into Imagineering and they show off the figure? You can Google it right now. It's on every website, presumably. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. You kind of expect that kind of video to be one that comes out of Tokyo and things like that. Like, we've gotten that exact video before
for something like the
Enchanted Stories with Belle, right?
Yeah, the Belle animatronic, and everyone flipped their shit. And
you look at it and you go, oh, that's not coming to America.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
The same as the cat from Shanghai Zootopia. So it's actually really nice that this is actually going to come to the United States. Whether or not this is like the one of the major animatronics in the attraction, kind of like the shaman from Avatar, or it's just a sign of what's to come, I guess is left to be seen. But
there's,
I know that they
be,
showed off the Mama Odie one as well, and that one, or they didn't show off the animatronic, but they showed off the concept art.
Mm-hmm. You could see the animatronic for the mom actually in the video. She's in the background.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and there's, from what I hear, there's 23 unique animatronics. So there's 23 unique molds, which means that there's going to be multiples, obviously. We're probably talking dozens of animatronics here. They're doing a good job on trying to do this makeover right. The only problem that I have with it is that this isn't the one in a long line of things to come. This is probably the last thing for a while.
Yeah, seemingly. Unfortunately, you know, Disney announced their future slate of updates at like the investors discussion, and it's slacking. It's a bit
bleak.
it is very bleak. It's like one thing for every one of the resorts. One thing that Disney does have to do over, say, Universal is keep all of the resorts up. That's Shanghai, Hong Kong, Japan, Paris, and then the two in the United States.
Yeah.
Not that I'm a Disney apologist now. I feel like I've gone through like a personality shift. I don't even know why I sound like this. But unfortunately, when you see that most of the updates being done are to the cruise lines, like adding an additional like Wish scale cruise ship and updating those kind of things, it's a bit unfortunate that this is kind of it for a while. I mean, I guess like why continue updating if you're kind of the top dog? But I do worry that once Epic Universe opens, it's Mario alone. You know, let's say Pokemon never even comes to the United States. Mario alone is going to give a real kick in the ass to Disney.
I would actually argue if they did pull the switch in Pokemon, Disney ought to be afraid.
They'd be screwed. If Pokemon opened a theme park, like Universal's connections to external brands have been really good. Harry Potter is still incredibly popular, though not as popular, I think, as it once was. Like the movies aren't coming out, but just the Nintendo property alone is insane.
Yeah.
And I think that, I don't know. I don't know what Disney can do, but they don't seem to be doing anything. So hopefully they just stay top dog. I think that's their assumption, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I will confess a bit of, I understand why they can't do anything in Florida right now. They're actively fighting against their own oversight district, even though they do have more power because they gave it to them. There are quite a few things that the oversight district still has a throttle on, especially construction. And so I understand right now it's difficult. It's difficult for them to greenlight anything over there. But why in the West Coast hasn't that Avengers e-ticket started? Like, that's such a small, that cannot be a massive piece of $60 billion that you can't start it. You showed that you were still going to build it at D23. So why isn't that happening? There's no excuse. I mean, like, it's an empty lot. Like, you own it. There's no excuse. Just build it.
It's tough because it seems like everything they do at California Adventure is a footnote. Like, if your goal as the Disney company is to lift the stock price and deal with the pretty poor control they have of shareholders and then some parts of the company, an Avengers e-ticket, even in California Adventure, is very unlikely to drive a significant foot traffic.
True.
Though, admittedly, the idea of the ride also sounds pretty bad. So maybe they're trying to.
We thought they swerved, and they were like, "No, it's still happening." In 2023.
It's a black box, right? Evil King Thanos.
King Thanos.
Well, the problem is they have to make one good Marvel movie before they can do that.
I see.
You know, they have the Avengers Endgame happened, and then ever since then, things have kind of just been not great, and I think it's kind of catching up with them. So
maybe Fantastic Four with The Mandalorian will do it.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll be in. Please, anyone in the audience, get me space 220 reservations.
Oh,
I was gonna say that I'll be in Universal next week.
All right. Well, that's okay. You'll be in Universal, but not Epcot.
Yeah. No, I will also be in Epcot.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I mean, only Universal for like a day, but I thought it's worth mentioning at the front here that. I don't know. I just felt the desire to bring up Universal because I know you like it.
Yeah,
I know that you're.
I might have to be able to help you out on Space 220. I'll talk to you offline. but anyways, for now, let us depart the present and head back way back to the Frontier's day of old, and the people who portrayed it in our main topic.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, green estate in the land of the free, raised in the woods so's he knew every tree, killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
fought single-handed through the Injun War, till the Creeks was whipped and the peace was in store. While he was handling this risky chore, made himself a legend forevermore.
Davy, Davy Crockett, the man who don't know fear.
He went off to Congress and served a spell, fixing up a government and laws as well. He took over Washington.
All right, here we are for our main topic. Today, we're going to be discussing Fess Parker's Frontier Worlds. Now, Fess Parker, he was an actor popular in the 1950s, which was approximately about 75 years ago. So I don't know how many of our listeners are going to even be understanding of the name Fess Parker. Dorman, you're well known on Disney history. At least you know who Fess Parker is. No. Come on, man. You
by name,
know.
No. By what he's done, yes. But by
okay.
name, no.
Really?
No. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, Lynette, like you look at, I take a look, I'm like, oh, I knew who he was by what he did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that the most interesting, well, we'll talk about it actually. There's one part of this that I'm more interested by. I think, but I know the name like by proxy.
Mm. Yeah, because honestly, I mean, if you listen to enough Walt Disney history, he's one of the actors who revolves around his sphere, such as Bobby Driscoll and Kurt Russell and Haley Mills and Annette Funicello. You know, it's one of those names that revolve around the Walt sphere, I would have to say. And especially, it's probably the one that is, I'd argue that is the one that is most connected to Disneyland. At least the original Walt Disneyland. Reason why? Well, we'll have to get into the history of Fess Parker in order to deal with it. And just to let you know, this it does have a long tail. So, yes, there is a theme park on the end of this, but we do have to unpack all this history first. So, Fess Parker was born in Fort Worth, Texas on August 16th, 1924. He was enlisted in the Navy in World War II. He was hoping to become a pilot, but was deemed too tall at 6'6". So you could see stardom in the making. was a radio operator dispatching out of South Pacific instead. He was discharged in 1946 at 22 years old. He enrolls into college. And this is my favorite part in his Wikipedia article. And I have no idea why it was included, but it is. It says, after an automobile collision, he was stabbed in the neck by another driver during an argument. You know, that just happens. Haven't
Lean
you
right
ever
over
been?
And stab him in the head. Yeah, why not?
Yeah, stabbed in the neck. It doesn't really say, you know, he suffered injuries because of this or he has a neck pain for the rest of it. No, it just says that. He was just stabbed in the neck by the other driver during the argument. You know, so the guy, like, he had like a pocket knife or something like that. Like, what was a stabbing? I don't know. Transferred to the University of Austin and became more involved in drama while majoring in history. He graduates in 1950 with a degree in history, studies drama at USC with his GI benefits for 1 year. So he initially is, you know, flirted with history and graduates in that degree, but eventually signs more into acting. And actually, that's really important for later on. In the early 50s, Fess stars in various plays and has some minor roles before becoming a contract player with Warner Brothers. Several roles have him in various westerns. So now we're going to put Fess Parker in the sidelines and we're going to actually move south to Anaheim, where Walt Disney has just secured ABC to fund his Disneyland Family Fun Park in exchange for a weekly television series. The series is meant to introduce the concept, was an anthology presented in various themes based on the lands of the park. The Disneyland television series is very interesting because everybody coming to it, the concept of Disneyland, thought that this would be a massive failure. But what I find interesting about this is, you know, once again, just like Snow White, they called it Disney's folly, but they were still thinking it was going to be a failure. After this show consistently breaks ratings records, and in fact is quoted as being one of the major proponents of television itself. And I always found that fascinating. Do you think that maybe that they thought that, okay, it would work on television, but people wouldn't actually show up to it?
How do you mean?
Like, okay, so critics of Disney thought that, okay, yeah, sure, people are watching these, you know, these television shows from their homes, but they wouldn't actually like hop in a car and go to there, even though they were like advertising this is what the vibe would be.
I think that, I mean, this is like pure speculation, but just going on my own thoughts about vibes, I wonder if the consensus was that, like, I don't know how I put this. The television was just something to be experienced like flat, right? Like mm-hmm. you just kind of watched the production and then right. you moved on with your day. It was what people watched over dinner. And especially mm-hmm. as adults looked on children's TV, let's say, there's a big distance between the way that adults engage with TV, which is like I'm eating my TV dinner and I have mm-hmm. It's on and then I go to bed or something like that.
Yeah.
Versus kids who are more immersed into it. Mm. And obviously, I think that's what pulled a lot of the people to this like real life interpretation of specifically these projects. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, kind of. I don't know if kids were a massive part of Disneyland's initial audience. I mean, certainly the first day was, you know, a disaster and overrun, and that was almost entirely all adults. So
it was kids breaking into the park, right? Like there were people, obviously it was adults, but I think
there was some teenagers. Yeah, I guess what you're saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think obviously something's new, but my thought would be that the longevity, I mean, maybe adults were into it too. Like maybe adults wanted to go see the real life. Actually, there's a lot we can talk about mm-hmm. with regard to this. In fact, yeah. I'm specifically with news recently about Trader Sam's. I don't know mm-hmm. if you've heard about that, the shift in the way that the mugs are.
Yeah,
shown.
Go ahead. I vaguely know about this, but
so from what I gather, I don't remember the guy's name. This might be something you can Google while I'm just kind of rambling here. But the someone who was previously doing mugs for Trader Sam's pitched yeah. like a newer one, mm-hmm. and this one predominantly featured masks, like tiki masks with. To traditional, I guess, Polynesian like caricatures mm-hmm. of the tribal people, the native people, I should really say, mm-hmm. Or the indigenous, actually, is what I should really say.
Yeah.
And Disney rejected it, and I think seemingly has backed off with working with this artist because they're pivoting to a different direction mm-hmm. under different management, which yeah. would see more tiki mugs, as we would call them, based on Parks characters mm-hmm. than those based on like the Polynesia of Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room and the 60s.
Which would like see as like cultural appropriation, are you saying?
That's correct. Well, I think that the artist in particular said that they're afraid of skirting the line, becoming racist. So, for example, if you look up the mug that he was pitching, the lips are very defined mm-hmm. and the masks are very outrageous and very big.
Right.
And they're very typical. They're something that you would imagine from the 60s or something like that, the 50s or the 60s. Because and we'll get back to the story you're telling in a minute, but
yeah.
the reason why Polynesian masks made it to the States anyways is because men who were deployed in Hawaii or even further west towards the various islands or even Japan picked up a lot of that and were interested by it and brought it home.
Yeah, that's what made tiki culture a big thing in the 50s,
exactly.
60s. Yeah.
Exactly. So when you think about, though, what was drawing a lot of these attractions to Disneyland in the 50s, and I think to your point, and it wasn't just kids, Disneyland captured kind of like that from like the 40s up until after I'd say we went to the moon, right? Mm-hmm. It was this question of, well, what is there in the world? Like the frontier, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Davy Crockett, unsurprisingly, the American frontier. Then Adventureland, the frontier west of California, so towards the oceans, to Polynesia, to the jungle, mm-hmm. even South America, and yeah. then even, of course, some Africa, right? Mm-hmm. And then Tomorrowland is like the space frontier. Like, what's out yeah. in space? Nowadays, we don't really have that. Like, we're like such a global society that now everyone's saying, uh-oh, well, maybe the way that white people saw the Polynesians in the 60s was a little racist. But I do think that, like, if I don't think that the people, the critics, were prepared at how curious these people would be to see the exciting new things that they don't know in their real life.
Mm-hmm.
People who are like from the East Coast don't know what the hell the American frontier is.
Right.
Right? They live in suburbs.
Yeah.
They live in cities. And now you have an opportunity to go see that exciting untamed land that's on television. That I think is probably the big draw.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But lots of critics, some critics didn't think that was going to happen. So I find that fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was, once again, this is a huge part, like, of, you know, what makes Disneyland a big deal, because, the anthology was actually presented in various themes based on lands of the park. So each week you would get a different land of sorts. Fantasyland would be shows featuring clips of his animated features. Adventureland would focus on his true life adventure series. Tomorrowland would be Ward Kimball segments that were science factual. Frontierland was to feature stories based on true historical figures of how the West was won. Walt's writers set on covering Davy Crockett. And you can see his portrait there. It doesn't really seem like who you would think, does he? He's very 1800s congressman, which was he was, but not exactly screaming frontiersman. Davy, in truth, did not lead the life you may think he did. The folklore of his life became mythologized upon the death in the Battle of the Alamo, which is also heavily contested. In reality, Davy grew up in Tennessee, possibly did some hunting in between moving because of his father's bankruptcy, being sold into indentured servitude, aka slavery, by his father, and then eventually being routinely abused by his father. It was not a very happy childhood. Then he got married, joined the militia, ran for public office, went to Congress, and fought against Andrew Jackson's cruel policies in reference to Native Americans, was eventually voted out of Congress, then went to Texas to join the revolution, where he was possibly maybe kind of murdered, or died in sacrifice, or died in the heat of murdering Mexican men, or who knows. There are many theories of whether or not Crockett died in the Battle of the Alamo. The myth-making of Davy Crockett comes from his daughter's last recollection of him. He was dressed in his hunting suit, wearing a coonskin cap, and carried a fine rifle presented to him by their friends in Philadelphia. He seemed very confident the morning he went away that he would soon have all of us join him in Texas. This, however, was enough for Walt Disney. Walt spotted Fess Parker during a screening of Them, yes, the ant movie, the giant ant movie, with Parker in a small role. He thought it was a good fit for the part of Davy Crockett, and Fess was hired in early 1954 alongside Buddy Ebsen, who played his fictional sidekick Georgie Russell. Walt concocted a three-act story to be told over the course of 3 months, taking a loose timeline of Crockett's life and overlaying the myth of the man in the coonskin cap and rifle in hand, applying it to all. The first episode aired on December 15th, 1954, as Davy Crockett Indian Fighter. Okay, that's what they titled it. The second Frontierland episode, where Davy and his friend Georgie join the Creek War alongside Andrew Jackson. Upon returning home, Georgie is captured by the Creek tribe, and I feel like I'm going to just go to hell for describing this. Davy challenges the Creek tribe leader Red Stick to a tomahawk duel and spares Red Stick's life by signing the American Peace Treaty, the same one in real life that occurred after a massive slaughter in battle. So that's one fictionalization of our relations with natives.
Yeah.
The second one was a better bill to swallow. Davy Crockett Goes to Congress aired on January 26, 1955, and has Davy fighting for the natives as evil, corrupt politicians are trying to usurp their lands. They do make Andrew Jackson way more sympathetic in this and just like slide Andrew Jackson in and put in an evil fictional politician. That makes that easier to swallow because a president can't be bad. You can't have a bad president, not in 1955. The third, of course, was the natural end of the story. Airing February 23rd, 1955, was Davy Crockett at the Alamo. I think you can guess what that was all about. The ratings for these episodes in particular were red hot, and Davy Crockett fever hit 1955. They were well known for not only showing the popularity of television at the time, but impressed ABC and made the fervor of Fort Disneyland much higher. Fest became a megastar overnight and one of the most popular frontiersmen out there. The song, The Ballad of Davy Crockett, topped the charts in sales of coonskin caps and bubblegum cards, among other items of merchandise, totaled $300 million in 1955 alone. If you watch Back to the Future, when Marty goes back in time for the first time in 1955, you can actually see a record store and they are selling The Ballad of Davy Crockett. And that is accurate because that was the best-selling record of the time and that week as well. I believe you can also hear Davy Crockett when Marty first enters the diner.
Hey, kid, what'd you do, jump ship? What? Well, what's with the life preserver?
You can hear it as well. And that's what would be playing. It was the number one hit. So whatever you're doing, look on the Billboard hit, number one hit right now. And imagine turning on the radio and you hear Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier. It was a different time. Fess and Buddy would do major tours as Walt took the three episodes and recut them into one motion picture that debuted in May 1955. That was a really quick turnaround, just like Moana 2. Are you excited for Moana 2? I think that's a good reaction.
It was the pivot to the topical comedy that made me laugh. I'm very excited.
Yeah.
To see a direct-to-DVD Disney sequel. Again, that sounds so exciting.
Yeah.
And you get to see it on the big screen, too. And it can do just as well as every other Disney movie has in the past couple of years.
Jungle Book 2 did really well.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, I actually did. It was really cheap to make and made a lot of money. Anyways. Of course, Disneyland opened in July 1955 with quite a bit of Davy Crockett presence, making Frontierland the most popular area in the park. And here you can see an excerpt from Davy Crockett Goes to Congress. Now, he's not wearing his coonskin cap, but this is how Fess Parker as Davy Crockett would look throughout the series. He has his rifle in hand and wearing those frontiersman clothes. And this captured Americans' hearts. I believe in the opening of Disneyland, like the opening special, they have like an entire like song and dance number fully dedicated to Davy Crockett's rifle. Terrific. Different times.
Oh, what a good story.
I've sure been a goner without it.
Tell another story, Davy.
One day I took my leave from town. I aimed a grin, a wildcat down. The beast and I began to stare. Was a growling grizzly bear.
One and only Betsy. I can travel far and wide with Betsy by my side.
Yes, sir. This is the gun that did it, folks.
Fess became a contract star for Disney and starred in a Davy Crockett prequel, Davy Crockett and the River Pirates, alongside other features such as Old Yeller. However, Fess was dissatisfied with these roles and practically livid when he learned that Walt turned him down for roles in John Ford's The Searchers and Joshua Logan's Bus Stop in the leading role opposite Marilyn Monroe. Walt would literally have people come to him, go, "Hey, we really like Fess Parker for these roles," and show him a script. And Walt would go, "Nah, I don't think he's good." And then he would tell Fess, "Yeah, I didn't think you were good." And he was like, "That would have made my career," you know?
Yeah, for what it's worth, turning down a role in John Ford's The Searchers kind of makes Walt like a stupid jackass. That is like such a stupid move if there ever was one.
Yeah.
Being like one of the greatest westerns of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think you want to be Davy Crockett.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair with Walt, I mean, nobody, it's not like you would have known this is going to be one of the greatest westerns ever. But still, it is such a kick in the ass. I know it is John Ford. Yeah, it's true. Fess is eventually let out of his contract by Disney and struggled to find many roles until Daniel Boone. This guy, again, look at this guy, white hair and all, is another frontiersman. You would have never known by his official portrait. Exploring and finding the settlement of Kentucky, Boone is also a fabled frontiersman and pioneer who had a strange relationship with the Cherokee. It was perfect for Fess, who eventually decided to enjoy typecasting. The TV series ran from 1964 to 1970 and is set in a largely time-jumping 30-year span before, during, and after the Revolutionary War, and was centered in Boonesboro, Kentucky, which was Daniel's settlement. The show was so highly fictionalized, the Kentucky legislator condemned it. But audiences loved it.
Daniel Boone, Daniel Boone, what a doer, what a dream come true, what Daniel Boone. From the coonskin cap on the top of old Dan to the heel of his rawhide shoe. The rippinest, roarinest, fightinest man the frontier ever knew. Daniel Boone was a man, yes, a big man. And he fought for America to make all Americans free.
Shortly after Daniel Boone ended its run, Fess retired from acting at just the age of 49. But in the meantime, Fess Parker was working on something totally different. Enter Frontier Worlds. And finally, here we come to our theme park for the evening. Fess was enamored with theme parks when appearing as Davy Crockett at Disneyland back in 1955 for appearances. Around wrapping up production on Daniel Boone, Fess Parker set his sights on combining his love of history and fame as TV's favorite portrayer of pioneers into what else? A theme park. Buzz Price, who else, did a feasibility study in Boone County in the late 60s and found an area near the city of Walton in Kentucky was a good option. They purchased 76 acres of an option on 1,500 more in the area and got set to work on planning. So what was Frontier Worlds? Guests would enter through a recreation of the Mayflower. Inside, the ship would simulate rocking back and forth and guests could climb on the top. Through the other side, they would reach Plymouth Rock in a vast faux wilderness. Instead of the truth of harsh winters and slaughtering Native Americans, guests would instead embark on a journey through time as America grows up as they circle the park. Per the Boone County Chronicles, the frontiers would take visitors through time, culminating in a science and space-themed area. The actors' plan included super attractions, the Rocky Mountain Thrill Ride, the Huck Finn Raft Adventure, the Salem Witch Whirl Through.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I know. And the anti-gravity walkthrough. What exactly were they is uncertain, though I have an idea of what the anti-gravity walkthrough probably is. No idea what the Salem Witch Whirlthrough is, but the park seemed like Disneyland without Fantasyland. You know, you had Adventureland, Frontierland, Tomorrowland. Guests could also mingle with actors portraying heroes and legends from Davy Crockett to Huck Finn to Daniel Boone, and also characters Parker didn't portray like Paul Bunyan and Abe Lincoln. But the middle of the park was a showboat on a river. But here was just a setting to see a show inside. You wouldn't actually sail on it. You would just go in and see a show. He also wanted to enrich the area around it with residential housing and commercial businesses. So it sounds good, but it wasn't built. So why? The nearby park of Coney Island, not the one you're thinking of, but Cincinnati's Coney Island, the family-owned park, wanted to relocate due to numerous concerns of flooding due to being on a giant river. In 1968, the family acted quickly due to the news of Frontier Worlds, knowing they either had to act fast or see a complete demolishing due to the proximity of the project. Tap Broadcasting purchased the park and started the relocation in nearby Mason, Ohio, eventually becoming Kings Island. Fess Parker infuriated one of the major owners of Coney Island, Charles Sawyer, who wanted to work with Parker but was rebuffed with no response. Sawyer would eventually work against him, finding out what banks Parker was trying to go to raise funding in and calling them in advance and advising against it. What a bastard. In the end, the lack of funding, the bigger competition of Taft and Kings Island forced Parker to abandon the project in Kentucky. So he sells the land, he has Buzz Price look at Northern California, and they settled on Santa Clara, California, and purchased a land, plot of land there. A theme park, a hotel, and an industrial park would be built on the site. Parker had Ray Kroc of McDonald's, the founder, picked in some funding But Parker quickly grew tired of dealing with both Ray and the city of Santa Clara and decided it was a massive headache. He agreed to partner with Marriott on building the theme park, but the new company kept asking him to reduce the historical and educational aspects. So originally, they wanted five possible historical areas. These would have included Settlement, Revolutionary Period, New Orleans, Oregon Trail, Southwest, and the Far West. I have been to California's Great America. If you're listening to our archive series, eventually later on, you're going to get an episode where I do talk about visiting California's Great America. But I can tell you, out of all these, the New Orleans setting, that's the one that kind of remains there from Frontier Worlds. But Marriott wanted him to keep reducing those historical aspects. Frustrated, Parker sold the entire park off to Marriott and rebranded, and it was rebranded as Marriott's Great America, which opened during the bicentennial in 1976. Marriott also opened an identical park on the same day in Chicago. Today, the Santa Clara Park is known as California's Great America and sits across from Levi's Stadium, home of the losing 49ers. It is due to close in 2033. How's that? So, Frontierlands is closing. Fess Parker retired from the entertainment industry. I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
No, it's closing in 9 years.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, but who cares?
Eventually, it's going to close. Fess retired from both the entertainment industry and the themed entertainment industry, settling on another love, wine. His winery produced numerous wines in Los Olivos, California, and also sold coonskin caps.
My dad was an actor back in the mid-50s, throughout the 60s, portrayed Davy Crockett in Daniel Boone. In the mid to late 80s, my dad stumbled across this piece of property here in the San Ynez Valley. I think in his mind, he was kind of at a place where he thought he was going to retire, but dad experimented with retirement on several occasions, and that usually lasted anywhere from 10 days to 2 weeks. About 2 weeks after he bought the property, he started talking about planting a vineyard.
I always joke that Fess was from Texas, so he couldn't do anything small. Initially, the plan was to plant some vineyard and sell the fruit to the 10 or so other wineries that were operating in the area, but he got too close to the flame.
Originally, the idea was that we were going to produce 8,000-10,000 cases of wine, and over the last 30 years, it's snowballed to where we are today.
Fess Parker, barring flirting, was running for the Senate as, surprise, surprise, a Ronald Reagan-type conservative. Ugh. Rested producing wine for a living until he passed away at the age of 85 in 2010. So now we've gotten the entire history of Mr. Fess Parker. We have to ask, what if? Let's really focus on that Kentucky park. What if that park was built? And I'm going to let you go. Give your opinion on this.
I don't know. What if I set up a shack down the street and sold hot dogs? Like, how would that affect geopolitics? I think that, unfortunately, it would have been a really tricky bind to sell on a wide scale a United States history-themed theme park.
Where have I heard that before?
Yeah, exactly. How many times have we talked about that in general? How many times do people keep trying to make a fucking United States history theme park? But
too many.
It's like, I think that this would have had it would have been more likely that you could have been a slave in this one than in Disney's. So that's a plus. It would have probably been deeply offensive. The problem is, and it's a very easy one to understand, is that yes, Davy Crockett, I guess, is like a public domain human, right? So it's not like Disney owns the rights to Davy Crockett.
Right.
But I do think that being separated from Disney would have seen a pretty big quality dip. And the one draw from a Fess Park or theme park would be some kind of a Davy Crockett experience. If it was like national, I couldn't imagine that it would be incredibly attractive to go bring all the kids to Kentucky to go to worse Tomorrowland. What do you think that that anti-gravity chamber is? Just like one of those rotating spheres?
Oh, I actually think it's really, really simple. I think it's just an upside down house.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, that's all I think it is.
I mean, this is the problem with this question is why I like talking about these theme parks is because we really range from like massive expansions to minimal road shows. And this is like You know that Flintstones abandoned road, like side...
Bedrock City.
Yeah, Bedrock City. That to me is what I'm kind of getting here, is like, there's nothing complicated in this design. If mm-hmm. they really cheaped it up, like you were talking about, if they did an upside down house for the anti-gravity, then it's even worse. Yeah. And I don't know what the draw is to bring people to Fess Parker's history class, because it's not like it's Gettysburg, right? At the very least, Disney's America was down the street from a real place where there were revolutionary battles. Mm-hmm. This is Kentucky. You get to visit Plymouth Rock in Kentucky, and it's like, first off, the real Plymouth Rock is boring as shit. It's a rock.
Second, I've seen Plymouth Rock, like, not you, it's in a photo of it. It's really funny.
It's like a little gazebo, and then kind of like you're in an ape enclosure. You look down into this little pit, and there's some rock on the beach, and it's like, whatever. Anyways,
like they speculate. It's like, it used to be much bigger, but erosion. It's like, isn't that it or something like that?
There's no way that... I mean, I'm sure that's what it is. Like, this is just a piece of the Plymouth Rock. Mm-hmm. It might even just be like a symbolic representation at this point.
It could, probably, yeah.
Like, what on earth... How would you even find the Plymouth Rock, mm-hmm. you know? But anyways, I'm not excited about this idea.
Really?
But I... yeah, I know. Though I do think that it is indicative of a very different kind of perspective when it comes to theme parks in the early days from the... In fact, you can kind of see the shift. Like, mm-hmm. Fess Parker gets obsessed at Disneyland with this idea of reliving America's past, present, and future. And also Tiki Birds. Not in 55, but... And also the adventure, like the Jungle Cruise and things like that.
Yeah.
But then by the time he's ready to produce his own park in California, it's Marriott, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Marriott is pushing and is like, no, do not do this. It's not interesting. Nobody wants to go visit these old American things. No one wants a history lesson.
No, nobody wants to listen. And nobody wants to learn on the weekend. They want to ride rides.
Well, the thing is, I never thought about this, but you do wonder if, like, the ideals of Epcot, if Epcot opened in its original 1982 state in 1967, would it have been incredibly popular? Because it seems like as they tended towards the 80s, as these bigger companies started to enter the theme park space, mm-hmm. excitement started to become a much bigger tenant than mm-hmm. this LARPing kind of go back to this part of time or look to the future mm-hmm. or something like that. Learning, I guess, is what one might say.
Yeah, I mean, as you remember, he initially went to college and got a degree in history. So he's combining these various things to be like, you know, what if I did this, but people learned, kids would learn, they would go on the Mayflower and they would learn that this is what took the initial pilgrims, you know, to the promised land, I guess you would say, and, you know, forget the people who were originally here. Even though that's a large part of the two characters I portrayed. And it's so weird, like, how there's a lot of... I mean, I guess when you're telling the story about how America was founded and us blazing a trail, you really can't ignore just how fucked up our history is, I guess. I mean, a Salem witch whirl through, which, I mean, I would hope was a tilt-a-whirl with a giant witch in the middle, and not a not like a little teacup ride where you pass by a woman getting hanged. Because
that's what it should have been. That would have been exciting.
Mm-hmm. It's like, we have Arthur Miller here, and he has written a wonderful tale that we will be dramatizing through various dioramas that you will ride past. And this is totally not, like, you know, a reference to McCarthyism or anything. Just ignore that political subtext. Well, it's like,
unfortunately, American history only becomes a complicated story. I mean, obviously, it's always been a complicated story, but in, like, the mainstream, in the way that most people engage with it, I think it only gets complicated after Vietnam. And if you're mm-hmm. a conservative, like, not, insofar the distrust of the American government between Nixon and then sending off kids to die in a stupid war, mm-hmm. It changes the way people look back. But for a while, it was just kind of cool. We were all called colonialists, and then the frontier, and, you know, mm-hmm. the people who lived out in the middle of the United States were savages and had it coming. And I think it's unsurprising that somebody who would become a Ronald Reagan era conservative, who was so old and so into history, but had such a reverence to American patriotism, that he would, you know, potentially be in the Westerns, many of which were racist, especially Davy Crockett, would try to make a theme park that's like, look at these exciting things that happen. And it was an excitement, maybe, that we fought the Native Americans. It was an excitement that the United States identity expanded beyond the Mayflower into this pioneering force. I think it's a little harder to do nowadays. It's also, it's at best, you are making a project for first graders. Like, that's how you read history in first grade, when you don't even understand what dying is.
It's very about Johnny sanitized. Appleseed. Sanitized, yeah.
And that's one thing, but it number one, it doesn't stand the test of time. It probably wouldn't stand the test of time had it been built. But number two, there's not really much of a room for expansion. This would be, I know that when Hershey Park opened, it was initially just a spot for the workers to like take their kids. It was a carousel and like a, I don't know, like a pool, I think, if I remember correctly.
It was like a bathing hall and that.
Exactly. And it expanded from there just by virtue of being popular. I think this kind of a local park, and maybe that's how we should approach this, more of a, the projected entertainment capacity of the ride shows and other activities would have a maximum design capacity of 26,000 visitors hourly. Disneyland has 110 visitors, 10,000 visitors hourly. So it's still a quarter size Disneyland, but that's not approaching local park. That's just approaching niche tier, you know, still a place that they expect a lot of people
to visit. This is not your standard trolley park of old. Exactly. This is supposed to be a legitimate Disneyland type theme park.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like that would translate very well to the idea.
No, I think it's naive is the best way I'd put it.
Maybe it was a different time.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I liked the very thin soup that is the Rocky Mountain Thrill Ride. So what? Like a roller coaster. It's a roller coaster. Is that it?
Yeah, probably. It's probably.
Is it in a mountain just like Matterhorn? Are you also ripping that off?
I don't think it's likely that they would have the function for the Matterhorn and back at the time. Insofar that like they could build something similar, but I don't know if they'd have the capital.
I kind of disagree. It's possible. They did do this at other parks, like Astro World had a mountain, a Matterhorn-esque mountain. So it's possible. It's just that it would look worse. That's all.
I understand that.
It's once again is a very strange time in American history where all these regional parks are popping up, and even though like nowadays they are very roller coaster heavy and not really super focused on theme. Lot of them were trying to ape Disneyland a lot, like especially Astro World. If you look in the history of Astro World, it's very strange. They used to have like a Jungle Cruise type ride. So I don't think that this is like totally out of the question, but the whole point of Astro World, you know, the main point at least, was to entertain. That was the whole point. It wasn't to educate. Nobody wanted to educate here. They wanted to entertain. That's 100% it.
I think that makes a lot of sense insofar that like you get the feeling the bread and butter of these smaller parks, especially as Marriott realized once things actually went to production in the 70s, was roller coasters. Like if you can't match Disney's entertainment capital and you can't match the expectations of Disneyland, then you go for what you can, which are kind of bare bones experience driven attractions.
And that's what leads me to believe that if this park was built, that it would exist today, but completely different. I think this would be it wouldn't be called Frontiers World. It wouldn't be called Fest Parker's Frontiers World. It would be called like, you know, I know there was Kentucky Kingdom existed. So you don't have to tell me about that. But let's just say it's Six Flags Over Kentucky. It would be completely almost removed. It would just, you would have like little excerpts that would be like, artifacts of what it used to be, just like how California's Great America now still has that New Orleans section. It doesn't make any sense. There's a Top Gun ride. There's like a flight decks in that section and makes no sense, but there is some New Orleans style buildings in there. When I was there, it was like themed to Mardi Gras and stuff like that. It still existed in there just as Fess Parker wanted it, but it's a completely an artifact. So personally, I believe that right now it would have completely not resembled anything it used to be, but it would still exist unless something happened where somebody was like, that's a good place for residential, but... I did look in the history. This plot of land is still abandoned. So
yeah, I mean, eventually, like you look at the way Six Flags Over Texas is a great example, where you look at the way that the park is split up into its theming, the Six Flags Over Texas, but very bare bones, like very thinly. The draw is roller coasters, right? So perhaps if this experience had been a bit more lax in its like production, that it was more roller coasters with like a general American theme. Not a good one. We would be talking about it like it's bad, but I guess it would have gotten finished. It was a very overzealous history directed park, unsurprising with his history background, but certainly not like proving to be valid for further expansion. It just doesn't seem like an idea that would stay really popular. So,
yeah. Again, I mean, I see what you're saying, but it is a theme park. And I think if business waned, some cooler heads would prevail. I don't think Fess Parker would go, you know what? We need more education. No, the business people would be like, just put another fucking roller coaster in there. Call up Aerodynamics, see what they got working there. And somebody call.
I think so too.
Anton Schwartz.
Then it would live on as a Six Flags. It would become a Six Flags, and that's it. Like we would talk about it, like, oh, Fess Parker built a theme park, and it turned into a Six Flags, or it turned into a Six Flags equivalent. Like there's just no future interesting production for this thing. Like you're right, it would wane. Then they would be like, well, this needs a roller coaster, and then you have like a local mid-tier theme park. And now we're saying, remember the Fess Parker theme park?
Remember that? Remember, you know, it would be strange like to have like this whole Disneyland connection to another theme park. It's like, remember when Fess Parker went and made his own Davy Crockett theme park? He's like, went to Walt Disney, screw this, I'll make my own theme park with Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone.
At this point, I think the Disney company probably wants nothing to do with Davy Crockett. So,
oh, you don't think so nowadays? Is that why they closed Country Bear Jamboree?
That's why they did it.
They're like, that's it. We're done with the last Davy Crockett presence in the theme park. In all of Frontierland, there's not like a little slice of Davy Crockett left. I can't imagine
the Frontierland shooting gallery may very well have coonskin hats, or there might be coonskin hats in like the one of the stores, or maybe even that the Frontierland loop might have a fiddle version of the Davy Crockett theme. That one seems far more likely.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's has to be in the background music because
I'm almost certain.
Oh God, this is the worst thing I've ever said on this podcast, but. Because I know this because playing the Walt Disney World Explorer CD-ROM game, they used to play the background music of Frontierland, and the track that they chose was Davy Crockett. So I know for a fact that at one time...
Yeah, I'm sure
it had it. Oh my God, I hate myself. So they have to have some sort of presence in the park. I mean, my God, one would easily argue that Davy Crockett is the reason why Disneyland was able to catch on, as everybody was in love with Davy Crockett in 1955. It could be said that Davy Crockett might be the most important thing to Disney parks and maybe theme parks as a whole, as a global enterprise. Maybe? What do you say?
It probably is incredibly important, and that's probably where it stops.
It started something,
and the money had to come from somewhere, right?
Yeah. Would you imagine?
The thing is, like, Well, you have to, those real life adventures are super important. And these areas have
quote,
gotten
quote unquote real life. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah. But you know, the way they were presented were like the real life stories or mm-hmm. true stories or what the hell was it called?
What, like
the what is it? The Walt Disney True Life Adventure Series.
Well, that True Life Adventures was the Adventureland stuff. That's like the exotic
stuff. Right. But yeah. It's that True Life Adventures, Davy Crockett, and space. The point generally being,
and then they're animated, they're cartoons,
of course, and then fantasy. Yeah, that is its own beast. But people wouldn't have you believe that. They would have you believe that. Yeah. As they
no, there was no IP. There was no IP.
No, there's no IP
in Disney. No.
No IP.
Completely original.
The problem is that these things grew like lives of their own at some point. Mm-hmm. And the way they approached the IP was different. Anyways, the point generally being that Davy Crockett, the DNA of Davy Crockett of Adventureland, of this, that there are new things out there that you can't see living in suburban America, that you could only see in Disneyland, mm-hmm. and that it's walkable. Like, sometimes I hear people say really, I think, stupid things about Disneyland, that it's like a safe space for people to walk around and not have to deal with real people in the city. I think that's an interesting point as an mm-hmm. essay, but not a really valuable one. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of media consumption, what it really is that you see from a distance, right, that there are other people in the world and they do different things, and that like humanity is headed towards a very different direction, space. But there's people in other countries, Adventureland, and people in the American past, Frontierland, and that's what you want to experience. Yeah. And that brought people to Disneyland until, you know, the world became more global and we started meeting more people and going, oh, they don't, you know, have bones in their heads. Like, it's not all racist. Mm-hmm. And then actually, naturally, that evolves into Animal Kingdom, which is a very educated and experienced, and I guess it's an analytical view of mm-hmm. like the way that Western culture has affected Africa, for example.
Yeah, until they bring the animals with the pants on.
The furries.
The furries, yes.
Never mind. I'm moving on. I feel like there's one group of people that it's okay to bully still, but that's okay. Moving on from that.
Aww.
It's okay if you're an audience member and you like that. Just
be nice to the furries. Be nice for the furries.
That's all we've got. We've only got the furries. No, they don't deserve to be hurt. But Zootopia is weird furry stuff. Anyways, my point generally being, yeah, if that and what's it called? What the fuck was that movie? Encanto and Indiana Jones.
Yes.
Indiana Jones is probably racist, though. That's the problem. It's like the principle of some white architect.
I don't think Indiana Jones is happening anymore.
I mean, I don't think anything's happening anymore. But I do think that, you know, it's interesting to see that develop in time. This park, however, I don't think it even has the original draw of like, I want to go experience these fantastical things. Walt Disney fantasticized the past, the present, and the future, right, in Disneyland. I don't think this park could have done that because it was too educational. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they should not have to not build it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. You just gave your answer.
I did, yeah.
Okay. That was premature. I didn't think you were going to that point. You know, it's interesting. You know, when you're talking about the what if, an attraction did get built, a theme park that I very much love got built, called Kings Island. I visited Kings Island. It's a wonderful theme park. Frontier's World seems like a theme park that would have been bastardized. It doesn't matter if you thought it was good or not, but it would have been soullessly ripped out and put in a bunch of roller coasters and maybe not as nearly charming and as wonderful as King's Island, which has the Beast and so many rides I adore. And I would have to say, just based on that, sorry, Fess. And you're probably going to agree with this because I don't think you liked the experience in the end. I think you were much happier making wines and producing wines and getting people drunk as hell in your winery. And your family still enjoys that winery. And I think your family wouldn't necessarily enjoy the fruits of Frontier's World because Frontier's World would have probably been sold to a soulless corporation who would have scrapped out all these rides and put in a bunch of roller coasters. And maybe FS wouldn't have had the time to make that winery. Maybe without the winery, he would be more assuaged to go into politics. And if he was a Ronald Reagan type conservative, he would have been just one other asshole that was letting gay people freely die of AIDS, helping the CIA traffic drugs to the inner city, and all those wonderful, horrible things that Reagan did to our economy. So maybe the world is actually better in multiple ways, not only geopolitically, but in the theme park sphere, and for Fess's own family that survives on 14 years later today, that Frontier's world was not built. And who am I to say that I should let that happen to the world, that horrible future? So I'm going to say no. Sorry, Fess. Frontier's world, no, don't be built. The world is probably better.
More old people need to fuck off and go make wine. More people need to go fuck off and make wine.
He was only in his 40s, man.
He was 49.
He was in his late 40s when he was making Frontier's World a reality.
And yeah, no, so, but like, I think that like you have all that money, just go hang out. You have so much money, just go hang out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go. You can just go make wine.
Just make wine.
Go live out your Davy Crockett dreams.
Yeah.
Just do that. You don't need this.
You don't need to do this. And that's why old people are never allowed to make a theme park. That's right. Yeah. It's only something that Bob Iger, who is in his 60s, is allowed to do. And
he's doing such a good job.
Yeah. And that, I don't know how old, let's see, how old is Mark Woodbury? Let's see, let's see here.
I think he's like 90.
He is, I do not have an age for him. That is interesting. Yeah, I don't have an age for him. I think he's 65? Is he in his 60s? I don't know. That is interesting. I don't have an age for him. Whatever. Those are the only old people allowed to make theme parks right now. Are people who are in charge of massive corporations who are leverage enormous IPs. Nobody else is allowed to. Especially billionaires trying to create theme parks in Georgia and crazy shit like that.
I think Disney should honor Fess Parker and build Frontier World now.
Well, he is a Disney legend.
Is he really?
Yes, of course he is.
I guess that's not surprising.
Davy Crockett.
He's literally Davy Crockett.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So of course he's a Disney legend. But they should build, where should they build it? Texas?
Kentucky.
Or Kentucky. Okay, they're going to build it in Kentucky. Disney's going to build a theme park in Kentucky based on Fess Parker's Davy Crockett, who had a very weird relationship with the Cherokee and the Creeks. Oh, the Cherokee was Daniel Boone. The Creeks were Davy Crockett.
That was the seventh key, is just racism.
Racism, got it. Okay. Yeah. That's totally what they'll do. Sure, why not? But that was, now, Dorman, you know all about Fess Parker. How do you feel?
I don't care. I don't have any opinion about him. What I'm most interested in is, I guess, what I was talking about on the top of the show, specifically because I was thinking about the tiki mugs before we came on. Mm-hmm. And it's the radical shift that has happened in only 50 or so years, maybe a little more, maybe 75, about the way that we view different things, like things that are different.
Yeah.
Right. There was like a homogeny in the United States, and then there was the outsider. And now it's very different, and it's become a very proactive move to eliminate that otherness.
Mm-hmm.
And one has to wonder what's left once you get rid of all of those things, because maybe you do have to change all of those things. Maybe you can't just keep being like, well, the Native Americans, they're different, but in different ways. It seems like Disney's more comfortable with being like, well, we have stories. We have these stories we made that no one's ever touched. Mm-hmm. Like Monsters, Inc. is just ours.
Yeah.
So let's just do Monsters, Inc.
Right.
Yeah, the Country Bears are just ours.
We don't need history. Fuck
well, history is unfortunately real, and you can't control reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true that the founding fathers and the presidents were like the founders of Western democracy, and the world would be worse off without it. But also they were racist, and they just were. And
yeah,
the things that they wrote typically had undertones of brutal bigotry.
It's all colonialism. You can't control that.
But also, for what it's worth, you can't control, like, in the Haunted Mansion, if you talk about suicide, you can't control that suicide is a deeply depressing topic that upsets people.
Yeah.
You know, the Tiki Room still being a thing is probably only by the virtue of it being Walt Disney's Tiki Room. It's more of a historical monument, right? You would imagine that the shift to under new management is a much more controllable topic because, well, we made Zazu, we made Iago. There's no baggage to them. They're just birds. And I think that the pivot to the future is going to be, well, what's currently in the parks and how can we adjust that? You know, Pirates of the Caribbean saw the same thing. Like the switching the redhead is one of the key parts of the ride where, like, you had to grapple as a viewer with something that was uncomfortable. And it was like, maybe not
anymore. Well, we got to
sell
Charles.
My big point here is that if the Country Bears in the new ride don't sing What Makes the Red Man Red, then I'll be deeply, deeply upset.
Well said. but I'll continue being in Peter Pan's flight because it's super hard to take those figures out of there. Super hard.
I think that the point right now is going to be if nobody notices, we ain't saying anything. Because the minute you go in and start pulling things out, the minute you have to admit that it's been there the whole time.
Yeah, and get on Fox News. The woke agenda has hit Disneyland and the Peter Pan.
Who is that? Who's that, like, the B-movie fucking lawyer? My heavens. He's like this deep southern man. That's Fess Parker.
Yeah. That's Davy Crockett comes in with his rifle. And is like, how dare you? How dare you take those statues down of the proud Native Americans in Peter Pan that were completely not racist at all?
When I watched the Peter Pan, I was thinking, it's like Mike Huckabee and Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
When I was thinking back then, that was such a strong man, and now you're taking him down.
When I saw him dance, that's how I wanted to be when I grew up.
All the white kids looked up to the racist. What's his? It was Buddy Parker, wasn't it? Who voiced? It's some white guy.
Remember. It's some. White
it was
guy.
Hold on. What makes the? What's it called? What makes?
What
the,
makes
the
red man red? Yeah.
Isn't it the same guy who does the Haunted Mansion thing? I'm sorry. No. Oh no! Wait a minute. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was a Native American. Hold on. Nope.
No.
Candido is his name.
Okay.
He had a very distinct radio voice. This is interesting.
Yeah.
Don't.
But I think that does it for now for unpacking our horrible American baggage. With that, we bid you adieu. Next week, we'll have another archive post. But in the meantime, please follow us on social media on Twitter at UnbuiltPod. You can reach me at Open Mother's Mail and Ryan Dorman at Open the Doorman. Feel free to email us at UnbuiltPod@gmail.com and rate us wherever you find this podcast. Please write a review and tell us how we're doing. And if you don't like us, thank you for listening to Based on a True Story. I'm Dan Lefebvre. See you guys.
See ya.
I hear you. Come on, boy.
There goes Davy Crockett in his bald skin cap.